What's cracking, folks? I'm Jared Dubin, and this is Quo Vadimus. Once again, we got Seth Partnow on the line today to discuss last night's TNT games. We had the Celtics and the Hawks, and then, of course, the record-breaking win by the Golden State Warriors over Kobe Bryant and the Lakers, or Byron Scott and the Lakers, or really just nobody, because that's basically who was on the court for that game for the Lakers. Seth, what's up, man?
How you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. Happy Thanksgiving. Me too, but mostly because of football reasons. Like, everybody just stops doing everything and concentrates on the Cowboys, which for me is great. All right, let's talk first about Celtics-Hawks. I thought that this was actually a pretty interesting game until the fourth quarter. The Hawks kind of blew it open late, and the game was closer than the final score indicated. One thing that I've noticed now, every single time I watch the Celtics, Avery Bradley makes every shot. I watched them play Houston last week, and he hit a bunch of threes in the first half to blow that game open, and he brought them back from a bunch early in the first quarter of this one. Yeah, and he was three for three from three in the first half at 1.2.
Yeah, and this game, I've kind of been on record as being at Nylon Calculus, the people who are the four guys who did like seasonal win projection, I think had the Celtics projected everywhere from like 47 to 51, and I understand how they arrived at that, but I was skeptical of that number. Super skeptical of 51 and not super on board with 47 either. And I think this game illustrated why to a large degree. You look at the start of the game, and the four best players on the floor were Hawks. And so it's, and maybe some of that is Marcus Smart out, but really, would you take Marcus Smart over any of, just for right now, over any of T. Corver, Millsap, or Horford? I wouldn't.
No, certainly not right now. Maybe in the future. And certainly not anywhere other than on defense.
Right. And so against, a good or better team, the Celtics have a lot of depth and decent players, but how much does that matter if you're starting every game against a decent team in a hole because, they out-talent you? I mean, you look at, Avery Bradley was hitting a lot of jump shots, but those were the shots they were getting because they had to work so hard to get any sort of look at all. And Isaiah Thomas is good and squirrely and all that, but just a lot of him dribbling around picks and in and out of stuff and basically just working hard to try to get looks and this is maybe almost an aesthetic point as well, whereas the Hawks are just kind of, the ball's swinging, they're cutting. The shots are there for everybody, and it just looked easier. The Celtics are going to be a team this year that they're going to beat the bad teams and struggle against the good teams, and given they have probably about the easiest schedule in the NBA, they'll win mid to low 40s of games based on that. But it's hard to see right now with them just giving up so much, starters versus starters. And then especially moving into the playoffs, it's just hard to see them as much more than kind of a scrappy team that wins the game that they should kind of team.
I would bet that, you've been doing work based on the number of starters on the floor. I would bet that they are a team that performs better as you remove additional starters from the floor. Like, if they were to have an all-bench unit against the other team's all-bench unit, I bet they would do fairly well there. Or if they had, three bench guys and two starters against the same thing from the other team, I would bet that they do pretty well there. But as you move back towards full starting lineups against good teams like Atlanta, then, you know, they're at a disadvantage because, like you said, the Hawks had the four best players on the floor to open the game.
If I'm remembering correctly, when I at least looked at last year's, you know, kind of full season data, there's a bunch of Celtics in the list of guys who had the biggest splits between, you know, playing against bench versus starters. And, you know, Isaiah Thomas was one. Evan Turner was one. Off the top of my head, I'm not remembering. I think Olynyk might have been one. And so just like of their better offensive players, you know, those were guys who, or at least their offensive creators, those were guys who, you know, did better against bench units. And that's, you know, if you think of Isaiah Thomas, like realistically on a, you know, a better team, what's his natural role is like the second unit, like super version of almost Jamal Crawford.
I was about to make the exact same Jamal Crawford comparison.
Yeah. A better passing playmaking Jamal Crawford is kind of, you know, and you know, that's nice. It's great. If that's your third guard off the bench and you're bringing him in with 4 minutes left in the first quarter and turning him loose until there's about, you know, 7 minutes left in the second, that's a great role for him. And unsurprisingly, for much of the season, you know, if you look at the how the Celtics games tend to go, it's, you know, down a little bit early and come back in the second quarter, and then the second half, you know, as Stevens has a chance to kind of see which of his, you know, 10, 11 playable guys should be playing on a given night, the second half they have, up until last night at least, just have done better than the first half when maybe their depth comes into play a little bit more. But still, you're digging yourself that much of a hole.
That's actually, you know, what you brought up about the way Stevens turns his rotation, where he knows which of his 10-11 guys are going to be playable on any good night. That's something that they actually brought up on the broadcast, where, you know, the difference between, you know, they were calling the Celtics and the Hawks the same kind of team without stars, but I don't think it's the same way, because the Celtics or the Hawks do have, you know, three or four very consistently reliable players that you know are going to be good on any given night, whereas the Celtics, it's very much more up in the air. You know, the difference between those teams is, you know, you don't know who you can count on from start to finish. And if it takes a full half to figure it out, then sometimes against certain teams, that's too long. You know, you need to be able to win the first and second quarter consistently to be able to win games. One thing I do want to touch on, though, not necessarily related to this game in particular, but with the Hawks in general, that Zach Lowe now at ESPN brought up in his post on sort of small ball sweeping the league yesterday. He said that Paul Millsap, who a couple years ago people were debating whether he was a small forward or a power forward, now almost has to play some small ball center sometimes. I thought that was really interesting, and I think I agree that it would work well, but I know you've done a lot of different work on, you know, size mismatches and stuff like that, so I wanted to get your thoughts on it too.
I agree with that. He's you know, it's not the natural comparison, but there's a lot of, at least offensively, you know, kind of similarities between him and a guy like almost Draymond Green, in that he is versatile enough to catch the ball on the perimeter, the ball on the floor, catch the ball on the move and make a play. The bigger difference, and the reason he can almost be punishing as a small ball center, is if you put a little guy on him. Saw a couple times last night. He's, you know, he's a grown ass man, and he'll put a defender in the basket and score over him. sure who, you know, if he should be on your team, and no one throws him the ball for the first 10 minutes, and then you look up an hour and a half later, and he's kind of, his team has won every game because he's, you know, made every kind of play to win games. And that just seems, you know, you don't recognize it, you know, necessarily unless you're really paying attention, but kind of he does enough things well that he influences the game pretty massively.
Yeah, and he made that sort of Draymond Green pass a couple times last night, too. And I can't believe I'm calling it a Draymond Green pass, given the amount of guys that have been good at it. You know, Tim Duncan, Marc Gasol, Joakim Noah, even, over the last, you know, 4 or 5 years. But Draymond makes the two passes, you know, the lob to the yeah. center at the rim and then the kick out to the guy in the corner. He makes those two passes so often now that it almost has to be called his pass. And Millsap made specifically that pass to the corner a couple times last night, and I thought that that was, you know, interesting to me because for the most part, when he runs pick and rolls, I feel like he pops out more. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but just, you know, the way I feel about watching his game, I think he pops more. But last night, I think he sort of rolled into the middle of the paint because of the way the Celtics were playing their pick and rolls on defense once Teague started getting in the paint every time, which happened basically the entire first half. And then I thought in the second half we saw a little bit more of Millsap making the plays, you know, off the catch.
Yeah, and both he and Horford tend to pop more, but they're both, you know, that pass you're talking about. And it's not just, you know, catch the ball at the elbow and survey and, you know, make a pass. The way they were doing it last night, at least, is catch bullet pass to the opposite corner, almost as the help defender, like the crash defender from that corner, is still moving towards the paint. Like the ball is zipping right behind him to the guy they just left to the corner for an open shot. You know, in my mind's eye, I see exactly what you're talking about, and that play they both made just repeatedly.
Yeah, and that's why I think the strategy of whoever brought it up on Twitter the other day of having, you know, that corner help guy meet Draymond or Millsap or whoever it is immediately on the catch doesn't necessarily work because they're sort of firing that pass immediately on the catch anyway. It's impossible to guard when you have somebody who's that good of a playmaker there. I do want to talk about Jeff Teague a little bit too, because like I said, he was getting in the paint basically the entire first half. Isaiah couldn't keep him out. They had, I think, Evan Turner on him at one point who couldn't keep him out either, which is not at all surprising. But there were two things that he did that were really interesting to me. In the first half, the Celtics kept doing this thing where they would post either Jared Sullinger or David Lee with Teague's man, whether it was Thomas or Turner or whoever, making the entry pass. And then, you know, this is a pretty standard NBA cut, but he would cut directly at the guy in the post, try to get like a rub. And then if he was open back door, you know, Sullinger or Lee is supposed to pass it. But because they had done it so many times and had not made the pass once at all, Teague, rather than continuing with Thomas all the way around the court, sort of ran an inch past Sullinger's ear and then spun right around and tried to take the ball away from him. And if Sullinger hadn't, like, accidentally fumbled it forward and then picked it up again, Teague would have got it. And I thought that was a really smart play because he had noticed that they weren't even looking for the pass along the baseline.
I think our friend of the program, Nate Duncan, calls that like an opportunity double, where you're not necessarily double teaming to stop a post player's hero, but doubling to create a turnover, to create a steal on a fast break the other way. You know, it's interesting because both Lee and Sullinger are pretty good passers, so they aren't necessarily guys you'd expect to be vulnerable to that, but that's still that, actually on him a little bit in the second quarter, and that seemed to work okay. And that was kind of, I think, where the Celtics missed Marcus Smart most, was the fact that, you know, Atlanta was getting kind of, you know, one mid pick and roll and getting a crease in the defense every time, because Isaiah Thomas is, you know, 5'7" and gets swallowed up by Knicks, and then Jeff Teague has an advantage and the defense is in a scramble. You know, wondering why almost you don't start that way, because you know that they're going to run endless pick and rolls with Jeff Teague, and Isaiah Thomas is going to get blown up by ball screens because Isaiah Thomas gets blown up by ball screens.
Yeah, and it also, you know, he started the second half for the first possession on Teague. And Reggie was like, oh, I like this move. They're putting Avery Bradley on Teague. But then it turned out that they just got cross-matched on a switch in transition, and they went back to having Thomas on Teague. So that didn't really work out.
Yeah, and especially if, you know, it's a weird matchup, and maybe you give up some of the young offensive boards, but it seems like against the Hawks, you would try to hide Thomas on Cephalosha or something like that with Bigmore
right.
out.
If they want to pound a Tabo mismatch on Isaiah Thomas, I think that you live with that against the Hawks. It's not only, you know, their least scary offensive option on the floor, but pounding a mismatch with a guy who's also probably their worst passer on the floor takes them out of their usual mode of offense because they're not swinging the ball all over the court.
Yep. So, much you said, Pablo was great last night.
Oh, yeah, he was incredible.
And him just being, I don't necessarily even care what he shoots, him just being aggressive is really positive.
And he had that one move in the fourth quarter where he had like the spin cycle, but he blew the layup, and he had not missed a shot to that point. And then he came down on the next possession and hit like a two dribble step back jumper.
Yeah. I think the everyone's collective response to that move was, ooh, wow. He's like, ooh, great move. Oh, no.
It was beautiful, man.
I think I scared my dog, kind of. plaintively crying when he missed the shot.
Go ahead.
So my general point there is that if he's being aggressive, like at least making the guy, his percentage almost doesn't matter. Because if he's not being aggressive and just kind of standing and allowing his defender to just like sit in the paint at the volume a guy like him or, and I've made this comparison before, but a guy like him or Andre Roberson or Tayshaun Prince or whatever, they can hit every shot they take, and it still wouldn't matter on net because you'd be giving up more just by the fact that his defender is sitting in the middle of the paint on every offensive action and how much harder that makes everything else. So him just saying, you know, hey, pay attention to me, and obviously, you know, doing so effectively is a huge, it's a benefit that goes well beyond just the points that Cephalosha scores.
Absolutely. I got two more things on this game before we move on to the Warriors. First of all, RJ Hunter's jump shot makes like that Ray Allen sound when it snaps through the net, and it is freaking awesome, man. I'm not sure what else he'll be able to do long term, but that thing is smooth as hell, and it sounds great when it goes through the net, and I love it. Second of all, on the Teague getting into the paint thing, that's something I actually talked to Kyle Korver about earlier in the year for something that I'm working on longer term, and you know he said that that's sort of the most valuable thing that can happen for a guy like him. Because the way he moves around, defenders have to pay attention to him. But when they see somebody getting in the paint, the instinct is to pay attention to that. And he getting, you know, 2 or 3 feet inside the paint is all he needs to wind up open enough to put up a shot. And I thought that that was really interesting that he said that.
Yeah, it's a basic defense drill, like, you know, you get the three coaches, like, swinging the ball around the perimeter, and you're doing a shell defense thing, and one puts the ball on the floor, and everyone, like, sprints, slaps the ball, and recovers back to their man, right? That's a basic shell defense drill. That's a habit that, you know, everyone has so ingrained in their head that even like, I'm guarding Kyle Korver, but it's like, you know, almost Pavlovian. Oh, the dribbling. I have to, oh, no.
Right, and that happened last night. It wasn't on the dribble, but Amir Johnson wound up on Korver in the corner in the fourth quarter. Korver gave it up to whoever was on the baseline, and Johnson just sort of instinctively turned around to go, you know, help on that guy. And then Korver wound up with a wide-open three, and they, you know, they were sort of laughing at him on the broadcast, like, what are you doing? It's just instinctual. When the ball goes into the paint, guys react to it, you know, and they forget for a second that they're guarding Kyle Korver.
Yeah, and that kind of specific, almost game plan discipline is the hard regular season thing. I think that's the kind of thing where if you're playing the Hawks for, you know, 7 games, it becomes easier to be more used to, oh yes, Kyle Korver, I'm thinking differently about what I'm doing on defense now because you know the second best shooter in the NBA is standing in front of me.
Right, and you're probably more diligent about, you know, not letting necessarily Amir Johnson wind up on him, even though Amir Johnson's a good defender. You don't want a forward, you know, a true forward like that cross-matched on Korver in transition, because that's going to cause problems for you. Let's move on to the disaster fire Laker defense in the other game, which I think more than anything else was the story that came out of that one, and I'm sure we'll talk briefly at least about Kobe, but the Lakers really never had a chance in this one because they couldn't get even basic defensive principles. Like, I mean, I was almost disgusted watching them try to play defense. Nobody was picking up shooters in transition. Nobody was rotating on the back line. People were hanging back on Steph Curry pick and rolls. I mean, it was, oh, it's like making me shiver to think about how they played defense last night.
Yeah, I think maybe with the first or second show we did when the Warriors played the Wolves, we talked about how Minnesota's defense with Zach LaVine starting was kind of allowing the Warriors to get whatever they wanted off their kind of first offensive action. Last night, the Lakers weren't even forcing them to get into that first action for the Warriors to get a wide open shot, right?
They didn't even have to run anything. They just sort of came up with the ball, and whoever was open was just open.
Yeah. And it wasn't even, like, a consistent way they were open. Like, one time, there was one play, I think it was in the third quarter, where they ran a flop check to Steph. Why they felt the need to keep doing that, you know, and he comes off a pin down and curls up to the left wing, and he misses the three, but he's pretty open. And then, like, there's like five Lakers like up at the free throw line or above, and the shot misses, and there's Draymond Green all by himself under the basket to get the offensive rebound and lay it in. It's just like, you know, it's such a total breakdown of everything that it's hard to even, it's so bad it's hard to even unpack how it got that way.
Yeah, I mean, and there were a couple times where, so there was one, Steph missed a three, and then Kobe and Larry Nance watched Harrison Barnes sprint in front of them for the rebound and pass it back to Steph for a wide open three that he made. Then there was, you know, Kobe missing a step back jumper and then literally not crossing half court as Harrison Barnes wound up with a corner three in transition. I mean, there's just like every single thing that I've written down here is nobody getting back on defense, and Barnes winds up with a three. Apologies. You know, everything is all about how they're just letting these guys get wide open every time. I mean, Harrison Barnes had four, I think, wide open corner threes or something like that. It was ridiculous.
Look
at the Celtics last year.
Yeah. Well, there's no Celtics are more talented than the Lakers. I mean,
no, yeah, but that was certainly what you would call, not necessarily a team that you would look at on paper and say, wow, that's a playoff team. But they played well and they got to the playoffs. You know, it was a solid average team that played above average for a significant stretch of the season. Oh, 100% it is, and, you know, you just look at the stuff he said after the game again, you know, like, it was not valuable at all to get D'Angelo Russell reps because the game was a blowout, and, like, he said that, and then he's also said he can't play him in close games, so, like, well, I don't understand, he can only play him in games that are decided between, like, 8 and 12 points, I mean, just what room is there to play this guy who's supposed to be a big part of the future of your franchise in important minutes. Like, is there just no room for that? It makes very little sense to me, and it's so damaging, not only on the floor now, but, you know, this guy who should be playing a big role for them is just not getting valuable time that he should be. And it's not like he's not playing at all, although there were a couple games where he played, you know, not nearly the amount of minutes that you would expect from a prospect of his caliber. But, you know, to have him, you know, it's really just frustrating to watch from afar, even as a guy who's not a Lakers fan, to see him not sort of not get a chance in some games to impact the game in important times. Not that there have been that many for the Lakers, because they've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 losses already by double digits. But it's getting to be absurd at a certain point.
And also, you talk about the quality of the reps also. If you're trying to develop him, he's not a guy you play like Derek Fisher, who kind of dribbles the ball to the floor, throws the pass, stands around somewhere. I mean, if you're doing quality development reps, don't you want to just, like, you know, I'm not the biggest, I'm not a super high on either player in this, but if you're the Lakers, if you're thinking for the future,
Yes.
Why is that not just, like...
That should be as big a part of their offense as the Steph Draymond pick and roll is of Golden State's.
It's not going to be good, but it's...
No,
at least,
but...
that's what you're building on, right?
Right. If this team is not going to be good, like, then you should want to build that for the future so there will be a point that it is really good. And if those two guys are going to be your guys in the future, which, you know, based on who else is on the roster, who the fuck else is going to be their guys, you know, then that should be something that's a major part of the offense. And it's a lot of times non-existent, so everybody can watch Kobe take step back 21 footers, or watch Lou Williams do the same. It's bad there right now in all senses of the word on both sides of the court.
Off the court.
Off the court, in the media.
Yeah.
It's tough to watch. It's tough to listen to. And I'm not one of those people that sort of takes pleasure in, you know, Laker foibles like a lot of other fans do. You know, I was a gigantic Kobe fan for the majority of his career until, like...
You can't see me, but I'm raising my hand right now.
Yeah, I know. Like, everybody else at HP, except for me and, like, the two or three Laker fans, is included in that group of group of people. I do think we need... There is one Kobe thing that needs a little bit more discussion, though, and that's why every sort of TV analyst, talking head, studio guy, is there some sort of, like, contract they signed that they have to pretend that he's playing the right way? Like, during the game, Grant Hill was like, he said, I wrote down the quote because it was so ridiculous. He's like, Byron wants young guys to look how he does it and follow his lead. Like, what about the way that Kobe is playing right now would you want young guys to follow? Like, why do we have to pretend that this is not, you know, a legendary player going out exactly how he wants, but doing things exactly the wrong way and being enabled to do that? You know, it's not like he's, you know, still making super smart passes like he did at his peak and, you know, making smart defensive plays and getting in on rebounds. He's not really doing any of the things that, in addition to his, you know, prodigious scoring, made him a really good player at his peak. He's not doing any of that anymore. He's just trying to take contested jumpers, like if they start magically going, like, first of all, like they will start magically going in, and then, like, if they magically start going in, all of the other stuff will return. What he's doing is not the way you should want young players to play. It's exactly the opposite of what you should want them to learn. And I feel like these guys need to stop pretending that this is what they should be learning from.
I think Grant Hill is a recent enough player that, you know, in those broad terms, I think he's had a difficult time being critical of people who were, you know, 2 years ago, out of his peers. Because he wasn't exactly a guy who would come out and take shots to begin with. And you know, like Chris Webber went through this a little bit when he first started being an analyst. And he's as he's gotten a little further away from his own playing career, gotten to be more comfortable. Webber is, again, not a guy who's going to be super negative on people anyway, just because that's not his personality necessarily. But I think that's a big part of it with Hill, you know, taking as a piece with his style that he's developed in general. So while it's particularly glaring in the case of Brian, I don't think that's necessarily.
No, I think that that's true and fair, what you're saying, in terms of not necessarily being able to criticize, but that doesn't mean they should outright pretend that what he's doing is the right way to play. Like, I think there's a balance to be struck between not going overboard and criticizing Kobe, because I think it's sort of a little bit obvious at this point. And it doesn't necessarily need to be said 100 times, but there's a difference. There's a difference between that and saying that he's an example that people should, that what he's doing now is an example that people should look to. You know, absolutely, look at the majority of Kobe Bryant's career, and, you know, if you're D'Angelo Russell, you want him to play with that killer instinct and to hunt his shot, you know, when he's looking for his own offense, try to get his best possible shot and make it. But the way he's playing right now in terms of not putting any effort into the other stuff, that's not something that they should be saying that young players should be looking to.
Yeah, I got nothing. I mean, it's not like we don't see many areas in which kind of the opinion of a former player analyst is slightly behind, you know, the time.
Sure, but usually it's the other way around. It's usually in terms of, you know, players from a previous era are always very quick to criticize players of this era, you know, whereas coaches usually will never criticize another coach. Players are much more quick to get their shots in and sort of say, you know, it was better back in my day and whatnot. And maybe it's because Kobe played in their day and is still playing now. I don't know what it is.
It's also, you know, guys, if you know, someone who was good 3 years ago, I think that we as fans who are, you know, watching all 30 games, and especially if we're, you know, doing statistical deep dives, all right, it's almost maybe easier for me to see how, like, Joakim Noah has declined. Than it might be from for a guy who sees, you know, the same kind of visible efforting things, and if you don't necessarily look at the score sheet and see he's shooting 30 whatever percent at the rim, it's harder to pick up that he's not effectiveness wise the same guy that he was. So I think it's much more, even though it's in the case of Kobe, it's pretty glaring. It's still, it's pretty common, I think, that, you know, it's the same, he's the same guy he was 3 years ago when he was an all-star, is hardly limited to analysis of Kobe Bryant.
I mean, it should be said that right before he tore his Achilles, he was playing really fucking terrific basketball. Sort of carrying that team almost by himself down the stretch of that season, because they were without Nash, they were without Dwight for a little while too, and he was really, really, really looking great, and obviously the injuries more than anything else have sapped his ability to do the things he wants to do. But, you know, it's one thing if you can't physically do the things you want to do, and it's another thing if you're doing or being enabled to do, you know, to play sort of the way that he's been playing this season, which is a different thing, I think, than just not being able to physically, you know, do what you want.
I think, you know, again, I think, you know, some of that is on him for...
No, and a lot of it's on Byron Scott. And the organization as a whole.
It's on Scott. I think it goes to the degree that Byron isn't empowered to, you know, sit him.
Yeah.
Isn't empowered to...
And that's something that I think that we've both heard.
Yeah, and you're not gonna discipline Kobe. Like, you're not gonna chew him out in front of the team or anything like that. That's not gonna happen. But there's other, you know, you can still coach, you know, and it seems like when it gets down to it, like, it's something that a lot of Laker folks on Twitter were kind of going crazy about last night. But all right, this game is over. You have 12 minutes of garbage time, and you look at the lineup they're rolling out there, and Larry Nance wasn't even out there. Like, there was, you know, there was like Huertas and Metal World Peace and Brennan Bass and Tarik Black, and Tarik Black is the closest to a prospect that they actually have on the court, where these are, you know, all right, the game is over, but they're, even the Warriors bench unit is pretty good, and you're you know, this is a chance to get some reps. Like I said, Russell wasn't out there, Clarkson wasn't out there, Randall isn't out there, Nance isn't out there. Like, what are you doing? You're especially, you know, in a blowout, like, all right, the back guys in their bench aren't going to be players. The Wizards have some guys, you know, whether it's, you know, Nance or Anthony Brown or the Pope team or whatever. I mean, some guys who could be getting some looks there, and they're just not, because I don't know. It's like, even by accident, the right decisions aren't being made there.
Yeah, and it's rough. I do want to wrap this up soon because I got to go travel back to my parents' house for Thanksgiving. But I want to give a last shout out to head coach Luke Walton, because history will never remember, or actually history probably will remember, because, you know, we'll still be alive, that he was the guy that started 16-0 for this Warriors team, because these wins, as many people have reported, are all being attributed to Steve Kerr. You know, Walton has a job that's not necessarily easy, but isn't exactly difficult either, given the quality of players he has on his team. But I think that he's doing a good job. You know, he's turning to that death lineup more often than Kerr was last year. And I thought that he had a great coaching moment last night. You know, usually when they play those sort of clips of coaches in the huddles, it's, you know, nonsense. Like, oh, we got to play hard, get back on defense.
That's what they're allowed to show.
Right, and you know, my roommate is a producer for ESPN. I know very well they're not allowed to show any sort of strategy. But, you know, the one thing they actually showed Luke Walton saying, and I rewinded and wrote it down because it was something that I thought played into, you know, a lot of who the Warriors are. He said, "We're getting good looks out there, but we're on the verge of playing a little selfish. They're not bad looks, but let's work it a little bit more." And immediately out of the timeout, they got a wide open Harrison Barnes corner three off of an extra pass. So good job, Luke. You know, keep doing your stuff. And maybe one day Kobe Bryant will remember your name and not call you Sasha. That's all we got today. Seth, thanks for coming on this early edition of our weekly podcast. You can find all this stuff on hardwoodparoxysm.com. Click on the link at the top of the page for the HP Basketball Network Podcast Center. You can find us on iTunes by searching for Hardwood Paroxysm, HP Basketball Network, or Nylon Calculus. Follow Seth on Twitter at @SethPartnow. I'm on Twitter at @JADubin5. Make sure you go to Hardwood Paroxysm, Nylon Calculus, Upside and Motor, Friendly Bounce. Doing some great stuff. Next week, we will return on Friday with a podcast for the Thursday TNT games, which, as I'm looking up now, will be played by
the Lakers.
We got Oklahoma City, Miami, and San Antonio, Memphis. I really like those two games. And I think we've only talked about one of those teams so far. We've talked about OKC and Memphis. But we have not talked about Miami or San Antonio yet, so that should be good times.
I actually don't think I've watched a full Spurs game start to finish the season, so I'm looking forward to that.
Cool, man. All right, well, let's end this right here, and see you next week.
All right, talk to you later. Happy Thanksgiving.
You too, man.